morning. May it please the court, my name is Adam Mueller. I'm a public defender and I represent Carrie Azzarrighi. My attorney registration number is 42176. This case implicates two concepts that lie at the foundation of due process: a trial court's duty to correctly instruct the jury on the law, and a defendant's right to be tried only for that offense contained in the information. Beginning with the jury instructions, the factual context here is important, and I just want to remind the court of that. Prior to the jury instruction conference, no one had mentioned the trust fund statute in this case. The first person to mention the trust fund statute was the court itself, when it hypothesized that Mr. Azzarrighi may have violated the trust fund statute, even though no such violation had been charged and there was no discussion of it prior to that point. The prosecution then picked up on the court's cue and tendered an instruction embodying subsection 1 of the trust fund statute. So this was not a case where the parties, this was a case where the parties were all on the same page going into the instruction conference, and then the game changed.
Let me ask a real preliminary question. At the trial level, defense counsel objected to the trust fund statute, among other reasons, but in part because he said, I think he said in the record, there are no material men or laborers with respect to whom a lien might be filed. Therefore, the statute has no application. On appeal, I don't see that argument, and I take it you've abandoned the notion that the statute could not be applied in this case. It could theoretically at least be applied in this case. There were material men and there were laborers to whom Mr. Azzarrighi could have owed money, or who could have filed a lien, more importantly.
Let me back up. The defense counsel did object on that ground below. That was part of the long-running objection defense mm-hmm. counsel made. Defense counsel also objected because it wasn't relevant to the case, it hadn't been charged, it would confuse the jury, and there absolutely was some discussion about material men, suppliers, and things of that nature. I have not raised a claim on appeal to the extent that issue was raised below. My focus here is on where the money went after Mr. Azzarrighi obtained the deposit from.
But there is evidence in the record that there were material men or laborers who could have filed liens, and therefore the statute could, on its face, be applied to the situation.
I would disagree, Your Honor. Mr. Azzarrighi, there were material men. Mr. Azzarrighi testified that he, in fact, paid the person who came out and measured the windows and things along those lines. But no work was done, ultimately, so there was no basis on which a lien could have been made by anyone, by someone who did some subcontracting work in this case. But here, what happened is that the court instructed the jury solely pursuant to subsection 1 of the trust fund statute. And it's my contention that that was erroneous for a number of reasons. The first is that there was no evidence that Mr. Azzarrighi violated the trust fund statute in the way it was argued below. Subsection 1 requires a contractor generally to hold funds in trust for the benefit of subcontractors, material men, etc.
Right. And if there were no material men, how could he violate the statute? But there were material men who did measure the windows and somebody else who assisted him in something. So it could have been, there could have been liens filed had those people not been paid.
Had those people not been paid, but the uncontroverted testimony was that people had been paid.
Right, but the statute says who have filed or could file a lien, and those are people who could file a lien, could theoretically, legally file a lien.
I don't think so in this case, Your Honor, because they had been paid. And no work was ultimately ever done, so they wouldn't have had a claim.
But you're not arguing that on appeal.
No, I'm not arguing it on appeal, absolutely. So turning back to instruction 10 in this case, which, as I said, embodies only the content of subsection 1 of the trust fund statute. And the trust fund statute, as discussed in the briefs, requires a contractor to hold monies received in trust for the benefit of subcontractors. What the trust fund statute does not require expressly is that the contractor put that in a segregated trust fund account. This isn't cold path. This isn't what lawyers do when I don't handle client monies, but if I were in private practice and handle client monies, I would have to set up a cold path account. That's not what this statute requires.
Was the jury told that they have to be held in a separate account?
Yes, they were, both by, I think, the
implication. In the instructions?
I think the trust, subsection 1 by itself, tells the jury they must be held in trust. You combine that with the prosecutor's argument, where he said expressly that the contract that Mr. Azzarrighi violated the statute by putting it in his 401k and not a separate trust fund account. Yes, the jury was told that.
So, Mr. Mueller, instruction 10 by in and of itself didn't state that the funds had to be kept in a separate trust account, did it?
By its terms, it does not say you must hold it in a separate trust fund account. Subsection 4, it just says you have to hold it in trust. Subsection 4 of the statute says, but nothing herein shall be construed as to require it to be in a separate trust fund account. So the absence of subsection, or the language from subsection 4 in the jury instruction, misled the jury as to what was required under the statute, combined particularly with the prosecutor's repeated argument throughout closing that that's expressly what the statute required.
Although when the prosecutor made that argument and closed, as I understand the record, defense counsel objected and the court sustained the objection and the prosecutor backed up and said it just has to be held in trust, not in a trust account.
I would slightly disagree. The defense counsel objected, and the court did sustain the objection, but then the prosecutor reiterated the argument that it had to be in a separate account. And I'd point you in particular to pages, I've quoted a lot of this in my brief, page 95 of the November 2nd transcript, 99, 101 to 102, and 112 to 113. But 99 is immediate. Page 99 is immediately after the objection. The court sustains the objection, but does not do so in front of the jury. He's at a bench conference, and the court did not instruct the jury to disregard the argument that had been made by the prosecutor. And in fact, although the court sustained the objection, the court appeared to misunderstand the statute. The court appeared to think it was required to be in separate trust fund statute. And in fact, on page 101, in sustaining the objection, the court says, and I'm quoting here, I think the full statute says it's supposed to be held in a separate account, separate from other funds. That's the court's statement. That's not correct, and the Attorney General hasn't argued otherwise. So after the judge sustains the objection, but not in front of the jury, then the prosecutor turns back to the jury and says, the money was to be held in trust. That's the law that governs, not this contract of the defendant. But the bottom line is, the defendant violated the statute by not placing it in trust and putting it in his 401k. There's no other way to read that, I think, than saying the defendant violated the statute by putting it in his 401k and not in a trust fund account.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. Okay. So crucially here, the instructions, I don't think, should have been given at all, because there was no evidence that Mr. Azzarrivi violated the statute in the first place. Assuming the court was correct to give instruction 10, the court still has a duty to correctly and completely instruct the jury on the law, and that required the court to also instruct the jury pursuant to subsection 4, which would have made clear to the jury that Mr. Azzarrivi was not required to put the money in a separate trust fund account. And I point this...
But there was no request for that instruction from defense counsel, as I understand the record.
We did not specifically request that instruction. We did object to any instruction on this point. And in fact, later on, when the prosecutor made the argument I'm complaining about now, we objected to that and said that's not what the statute requires.
But there was no specific request during the instruction conference. Judge, if you're going to instruct on subsection 1, you need to tell them what subsection 4 says.
No, there was not. There was not a specific request for that. And even if this court were to review partially this issue for plain error, because I think it's largely preserved, the trial court itself thought the statute was relevant. The trial court misunderstood what the statute required, but the court was the first one to bring it up. And so it should have been obvious to the court to correctly and completely instruct the jury pursuant to the statute. No other, the parties weren't prepared for this. This had never come up until the judge brought it up for the first time in the jury instruction conference. I would point this court particularly to a decision in People versus Colliver from 1983. And that's a case also charging theft where the jury was instructed pursuant to the trust fund statute. And in that case, the defendant took monies under a contract to perform some landscaping and remodeling work, put it in his business account, withdrew the money from the business account, and then the account was closed for insufficient funds and the money was gone. And the jury was instructed pursuant to the trust fund statute, but they got both subsection 1 and subsection 4. And the Court of Appeals' opinion is clear on that point. The jury was correctly and completely instructed pursuant to the law, not what happened here. So the defendant in that case did violate the trust fund statute because he didn't keep it in trust. The money was gone. He spent it, presumably, or there was evidence that he spent it for purposes prohibited by the statute, but the jury was correctly instructed. That's not what happened here.
Excuse me, counsel. By putting it in a retirement account, essentially, where there are limitations on ability to withdraw it, couldn't the jury have concluded that there was no intent to repay the funds or use them for the purposes for which they've been paid.
A couple of points, Your Honor. First, there was no testimony about what kind of 401k account this was. All we know is a 401k account. There was no testimony that he could or couldn't withdraw. Some people, you know, I have a Roth IRA.
Couldn't the jury have concluded, based on its own knowledge of what a 401k account is, that there was an intent to permanently deprive the lady who hired him of getting her work done or, you know, getting the funds back?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because, as I said, I have a Roth IRA. I can withdraw money from that. My contributions can be withdrawn tax-free. There are penalties in certain cases if I withdraw. I don't think that's a reasonable inference.
I think you would have had a better case if it hadn't been put in 401k.
Right. I'm sorry?
I think you would have had a better case if your client had not put the money in 401k.
I think we would have had a better case, maybe, but that doesn't mean that this wasn't reversible error. And the second point, Your Honor, is this wasn't charged as intent to permanently deprive. That's not how the case was tried to the jury. The case was tried to the jury under a different section, subsection of the theft statute, which was knowingly obtaining money,
without authorization.
And knowingly concealing it so as to permanently deprive. My client's intent wasn't an issue in this case. And I turn briefly before, I do want to save some time for rebuttal, but I want to turn briefly to the prejudicial variance argument, because even if you disagree with me on everything we've just talked about, there was a prejudicial variance in this case, and it was preserved below. And the state has not shown that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, a variance occurs, of course, when the elements of the charged crime are the same, but the facts are materially different than everyone had assumed they would be. And in this case, it could have been straightforward. They could have simply tried the case as my client took the money, didn't do the work, he knew he wasn't going to do the work, and he obtained the money and held it so as to permanently defraud. That's not what they did. By the time of closing argument, my client's knowledge had nothing to do with it. My client's, our defense all along was we didn't knowingly take the money without authorization. We thought we were entitled to it under the contract because it was non-refundable.
It doesn't say that in the contract. It doesn't say that it's not refundable.
I've
read the contract. Where does it say that?
It says this contract can be canceled only within 72 hours.
Yeah, it doesn't say that it's not refundable.
I think it's a reasonable inference from that it's non-refundable if not canceled within 72 hours. There wasn't any disagreement that was a plausible inference. We got a theory of the case instruction embodying that defense. It was a defensible case.
I understand that you did. I suspect it may have been an error, but go ahead.
I would say that the Attorney General hasn't argued that it was error to give us that defense. And ultimately, this case is a lot like Rice, because we went in, which I cited and discussed in my briefs, we went into trial with a unified theory of defense on the mens rea, which became utterly irrelevant by the time of closing argument. We went in saying we didn't knowingly take the money without authorization. By the end of trial, it didn't matter whether we knowingly took it without authorization or didn't, because by putting the money in the 401k, we violated the trust fund statute, according to the prosecutor, an argument that was confirmed, at least, or impliedly confirmed by the jury instructions. And we've got a unanimity problem there, and we have certainly a notice and variance problem there as well. I only have a couple minutes left, so I reserve my time unless there are any other questions at this point.
May it please the court. My name is Molly McNabb, registration number 43804, and it is my honor to represent the people in this case. This is a theft case. It was charged as a theft case, it was prosecuted as a theft case, and the defendant was ultimately convicted by the jury of theft. There's really no confusion about that. And in that context, it really makes clear a lot of these legal arguments. I'd like to turn to the prosecutorial misconduct issue first, because I think there's some factual clarifications that need to be made in regards to how the closing argument was made. The prosecutor started the closing argument and finished the closing argument in the context of the one and only charge here, which was theft. The prosecutor defined theft, read it essentially from the jury instruction that was given, the elemental instruction for theft, and went through element by element of the entire theft statute. And in doing so, it was only when the prosecutor got to the without authorization or by deception that he introduced the concept of the lien statute in order to show the defendant's intent to keep the victim's money and use it in a way that was contrary to the victim's purpose for giving him the money in the first place. The prosecutor never argued that there was a violation of the lien statute, that there was a violation of Instruction 10, never argued that there was a violation of the contract statute that was given. Rather, that statute, just as we see in People v. Colley, that statute was used to rebut the defendant's theory of defense and to show that intent element of theft.
Ms. McNabb, didn't the prosecutor, though, mistakenly say during his closing argument that the defendant did not put the money in a separate trust account?
Yes, so there was one mention that as was discussed just now by defense counsel, was objected to. That objection was sustained. And that objection is based on something that's very important to this case, which is the difference between held in trust and a separate trust account. Here we have a case that the prosecution only intended to use the first subsection of the lien statute, which includes a requirement, which is basically a requirement that a contractor or subcontractor hold money in trust for the purposes of paying other subcontractors, purchasing materials, things of that nature that are consistent with the contract. Subsection 4, which was not instructed on and was not part of this trial, has a requirement, or actually makes clear that the defendant is not required to hold that money in a separate trust account. They must maintain separate records, but does not have to have a separate account for that project only. So there's a very distinct and important difference here between holding in trust and a separate trust account. The one time when the prosecutor did slip into saying that there had to be a separate trust account, defense counsel objected, the trial court sustained the objection.
Well, actually, at page 95 of the transcript, the prosecutor says Cary Azzurriti said that he violated the law. He did not place those funds in a trust account, a portion of which is going to help him retire. Confusing, but there's no, he violated this provision as to contract funds. There's no objection there. 5 pages later, when there's sort of an allusion back to it, there was finally an objection. I mean, counsel didn't object to that part of the closing argument. So I don't know if that helps you or not, but there wasn't, when he actually mentioned it, there was no objection. Later on, page 99, there is an objection.
Right. Well, at best, that would be an unpreserved, that would be reviewed for plain error. But I believe that this, what the prosecutor, this has to be read in context of what the prosecutor is arguing, what the prosecutor is trying to do here. The defendant's theory of defense was that he believed, under the contract, according to contract law, he had a right to the money and he didn't have to return it. That's the same theory of defense that we see in People v. Colley, where the theory of defense was that the contract couldn't be completed because of the uncooperativeness of others involved in the contract. Just as here, the defendant was alleging that the victim was uncooperative and he couldn't complete the contract, but he didn't have to give the money back.
Could the defendant here have been convicted, as his counsel suggests, for not putting the money in a separate account? Could the jury have convicted him on that basis, or based on these instructions?
No.
Why not?
The jury was specifically instructed by the jury instructions that said that the defendant is charged with theft. The judge instructed on the elements of theft. The jury was instructed that they had to find each element of theft beyond a reasonable doubt. And the prosecutor started his closing argument talking about theft, talked about the theft elements the entire way through, concluded his closing argument requesting that the jury convict on theft. There was no possible way that the jury could have been confused to think that this jury instruction 10 was somehow some alternate theory of conviction when it was used only for an element of the theft statute in that context only.
Which element?
The without authorization and by deception. And that specifically goes to the defendant's theory of defense, which is that he had authorization. He was keeping the money because he was supposed to keep the money under the contract. And the prosecutor, just as we see in Colley, properly used the lien statute instruction to rebut that theory of defense.
So when he put the money in his 401k, that was not authorized? That's how the jury was supposed to understand this, maybe?
Well, the use of the 401k was to show intent. It was not to show that there was, should have been a separate account, there should have been different banking practices. It was to show the defendant's intent to permanently deprive, to keep this money without using it for the purpose of completing the contract. That was the purpose of showing that it was in a 401k. And I would like to clarify just a few facts about the 401k.
Can I ask you one question before you move on, though?
Yes.
And was intent to permanently deprive an element of this case?
Sorry, I did slightly misspeak. No, it
okay,
was
okay, I did too a few minutes ago, but just wanted to clarify.
The without authorization and by knowingly without authorization and by deception was the element that the jury was required to find here, and that was the element to which the defendant's theory of defense went to, which was that he was the prosecution was prosecuting on a theory that he was initially authorized. Everyone agreed that was not contested. But then with the authorization was essentially withdrawn, that he wasn't completing the terms of the contract, and that he should have either done the contract, completed the contract, or given the money back, and he didn't. And the defendant's theory was that he believed he was entitled to keep that money. And to rebut that theory, the prosecution introduced this jury instruction 10 to aid in its rebuttal, to show that it wasn't the defendant intended to keep this money in a way that he was not authorized to keep it.
Let me ask you about the variance argument, about which I think we're going to hear more in just a couple minutes. The charge is just the plain vanilla theft charge.
Yes.
There was no mention of the lien trust statute in the indictment. But the lien trust statute was really just, was it just a theory of how he committed the theft? And is it necessary to charge in the indictment the theory by which the theft was committed?
I think you could put it that way, and no, it's not necessary to charge based on the theory. The theft statute is what was charged. The facts that were presented at trial were presented not only in the way in which it made clear to the jury that we're all talking about theft here, this is a theft charge, but also the facts supported the theft charge. And that's essentially what variance is, when the facts are convicting the defendant of something that is not charged. But here, all of the facts that we have in play go to his, whether or not he was authorized to continue to keep that money and keep it in his own personal account, showing he intended to not complete the contract. And intent is an element of theft. And that's exactly what the prosecutor argued these facts went to, was his intent, what he was going to do with the money. And in addition, there's no possible way this could have prejudiced the defendant, because it was his own testimony. He could not have been surprised by the fact that the money was in his own 401k. He testified to this on cross-examination. And this is very similar to, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing this name right, but People v. Hyun. And there the Court of Appeals found that there was no prejudice, where the evidence the defendant contended constituted a variance was his own statements. And we have the same thing here. It couldn't have been a variance when the only fact that's in dispute here, or the only alleged fact that could have constituted a variance, is a fact that the defendant himself presented at trial. Just mentioning briefly, the defense counsel asserted that there were no facts about the nature of the 401k, but the defendant did testify at trial that it was a personal account, it was his retirement account, his business accounts were closed, and he put his money in this, and the only two people with access to the account, to this personal account, were him and his wife, and they were listed on the account. So this was not his business account. And again, that's not what the defendant was charged with violating. There was no problem with the lien statute. That's not what the prosecutor was arguing.
I haven't looked at the lien statute in a while. Is it even a criminal offense?
No.
So it doesn't be charged as a crime by itself, would it?
No. And actually, I believe it's subsection 5 makes clear, it says any person who violates the provisions of 1 and 2 of this section commits theft as defined in, and then the section for statute for theft. And there are cases that say that charging the lien statute is not a, cannot be a criminal charge. You have to charge theft, prove the elements of theft, and convict based on theft, which is exactly what happened here. If there are no further questions, the people respectfully request that this court affirm.
Thank you, Ms. McNabb. Council, you have about a minute and 53 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a couple of points I'd like to make. Regarding the prejudice here, the prejudice is not that we didn't have notice of where the money was. Of course, it was our testimony that the money was in the 401k. You can show prejudice in another way, and here we have that. This is People v. Rice. In People v. Rice, the defendant testified as a defense to the computer crime charge that she thought the money belonged to her, and therefore she was not guilty of theft. There was a variance, and the prosecution argued in conjunction with the jury instructions. Didn't matter what the defendant thought. Didn't matter who the money belonged to. What matters in that case is that she misrepresented her employment status. And that was the prejudice, because the defense gets completely undercut. And the same thing happened here. Our defense is, we didn't knowingly take the money without authorization. We thought we were entitled to it. By the time the prosecutor argues he violated the trust fund statute by putting it in his 401k, it doesn't matter what we thought, whether we were entitled to the money or not. All that mattered was it was in the 401k.
But the theory of defense that you just articulated was presented to the jury, and the jury could have agreed with the defendant and said, oh yeah, he was right to think he had the right to keep the money. There was no, the idea that he put it in his 401k, that he took the money without authorization was simply, the evidence of that was that he put it in his own account, in his trust account.
I would disagree.
Contrary to the statute.
I would disagree for this reason. I don't think where the money is in a business account or in a 401k account has anything to do with whether it was authorized or not. The question in this case was whether the money was non-refundable. It doesn't matter if it's in his 401k or in his personal account.
So let me ask you the same question. Could this jury have found that just because he didn't keep it in trust, he violated the statute?
Yes, and in fact, that's what the prosecutor argued. I don't think the statute allows that.
In a separate account, he could have been. But the jury instruction is nothing about having to keep the money in a separate account. It's simply the prosecutor's argument.
If I could respond, I see my time is up.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'll be very brief. In the absence of a instruction pursuant to subsection 4. Of the statute, which says it shall not be a separate trust fund account, there's no way I think the jury would understand the instruction 10 to say anything other than it had to be in account, particularly with the prosecutor's repeated arguments, which I quoted in my brief, right. He violated the law, etc.
But of course, there was no request for the instruction or subsection 4. So we're going around in circles, but thank you for your argument.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And I'd ask this court to reverse. Thank you.